Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much, Master Host, for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day. In 1899, the President of South Africa at the time, or rather the Prime Minister, no, President of South Africa at the time, Paul Kruger, would issue a 48-hour ultimatum to the British, instructing them to leave certain areas, and failing to do that would declare war. We of course know that the Second Boer War would start 2 days later, so clearly they didn't heed that call. 1940 on this day, the former health minister of South Africa, the late Mantu Shabalala Msimang, was born on this day. Interestingly enough, on the other side of the world, John Lennon was also born on this day in 1940, so they share a birthday. 1941 on this day, Franklin Roosevelt, the President of the United States, would approve the first, or would approve the atomic project we would then later know as the Manhattan Project. In 1946 on this day, the first ever electric blanket would be manufactured. It would go on to be sold for just under $40. In 1962, Uganda would gain independence from Britain, yes, as always. In 1978, P.W. Botha would succeed John Vorster as the Prime Minister of South Africa. In 1987, a stamp called Lady McGill would be bought by a Japanese bank for $1.1 million. In 2023 on this day, Robert F. Kennedy, the nephew of the late John F. Kennedy, would launch his independent presidential campaign. You have to have a really big bank balance to launch an independent campaign in the US. But you're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at other people's bank balances. We're going to be looking at Google. They could be forced to unbundle their business, go into some very interesting conversations, and that split is as a result of the law potentially seeing Google as an illegal monopoly. That's going to be an interesting conversation to dig into. Then we've got a conversation with independent economist Glenn Robbins around the latest court interdict preventing Transnet from finalizing that privatization deal for their Durban port. And then we've got a conversation with the guys at Nielsen IQ around the latest consumer outlook report that they've put together that suggests that consumers are still making decisions based on their circumstances and not necessarily based on what's happening in the world. Then, because it's Wednesday, it's Executive Lounge on a Wednesday, we're going to be chatting to someone that we've spoken to before on the show, not in an Executive Lounge capacity, but we're going to be getting to know a little bit more about Wayne Duvenacher, the CEO of Outer.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's been a very interesting day of movements, and I know someone who's been keeping an eye on those movements is my guest now, Simon Brown, founder at Just One Lap. Good evening, Si. Lovely to speak to you. Feels like we do this quite often. Markets, we're in October. I get that it's spooky season. I get that Halloween is at the end of the month and all of those sorts of things. But the markets today, having gone from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum, only to finish flat, what's having the market spooked?
Lots of spooking. It was a quiet day in the market. There was 15 billion of trade done, which used to be our average, but we've been topping at 20 billion more recently, and I think that certainly got market spooked. We're in a weird zone where there's not much news flow happening at the moment in terms of results. The August period end companies will start coming out probably in the next 10 days or 2 weeks. At the moment, what's spooking the market? We had a rand a whole lot weaker today. We had oil bouncing all over the place. That's been worrying. The market oil is down so far today, which is looking better. But gold's been under a smidgen of pressure as well. And of course, FOMC minutes come out in a couple of hours, I think 8:30 our time, from the September meeting. And absent of anything else, the market's kind of hanging on to that and seeing what was the sort of behind-the-scenes data from that 50-point rate cut in the U.S.
So I saw something a little earlier. Analysts are saying that the Chinese stimulus has underwhelmed or underdelivered, so to speak. And you look at Asian markets, and they were a mess today. I mean, Shanghai was down 6%. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong wasn't doing much better. You'd think coming back from Golden Week that we'd see some form of a rally or some form of positivity, but it doesn't seem like Asian markets are giving that.
No, they're not. You're a hard taskmaster. So, if we look at Hong Kong markets, because they didn't, I mean, they basically got back to levels last seen at the beginning of last year. So call that 21-month highs that they got back to. That was a big deal. The trick is that the stimulus that's going to come from China is going to be slowish. Their problem is housing debt held by consumers. It's not a structural problem. It's just they got over indebted in the housing market. We understand that story, and that needs to unravel essentially. And it's going to be a bit of a process. And I know when the initial excitement and moves happened, my sense was, have they got ahead of themselves? I mean, all of the excitement around the commodity stocks. I mean, if this works, commodities will rise, but they weren't going to rise on that Tuesday 2 weeks ago.
Those commodities prices, I mean, you and I have been looking at resource counters, and we've been looking at the resources index as well. It doesn't look like there's a lot of movement there. There clearly is a lot of fear that sits in the market right now around, is that Chinese demand going to actually spur on commodity markets? Is there a backup plan here?
Yes, there is to a degree. I suppose it's the US. We're seeing a lot of onshoring happening, and we're seeing a lot of course, the energy transition. Both of those are broadly good for commodities, some commodities more than other. And many others have spoken about copper a lot in that regard. But my sense is, I mean, the demand will come through at a point for a number of reasons. Partly, we see production being cut. We've spoken to the Platinum Council. They see deficits continuing. We're currently in deficit for platinum in particular. I think the backup plan is just a global economy which doesn't recession, which manages to do a two and a bit GDP growth. So it's slowed, and it's not phenomenal, but it's enough to keep things going. And with production cuts in a year or two, and it's a ways away, maybe sooner, but things start to look better in the commodity space.
Sai, if we take that outlook and we kind of go into the next year or two and we say, okay, global growth will probably hit around 2%, 2.5%. For the president of South Africa to say 3% for South Africa and a couple of other ministers as well to say that 3% is realistic, are we now going to be able to realistically meet those kinds of expectations?
I think so. So, the president stole my thunder. I said 3% GDP for 2025 a month or so ago, and the math is simple-ish. Let's assume 1% for 2024. That might be generous, but it makes the math easier. I think the two-pot system can easily add 0.5%. So now we're at 1.5. I think the absence of load shedding can add perhaps 0.75%. Now we're at 2.25. We've also got rates coming down. We've got low inflation, just generally a more positive mood. 3% is not impossible. And I think what's important is it doesn't need the government to come to the rescue and help us out. It's enough just that an economy that's had a foot in its throat for a decade plus, maybe, with load shedding and everything else, suddenly gets a chance to breathe.
Just a little bit of breathing room. You'd be amazed at what you can get done with all of that. Sai, let's look forward to those minutes. You touched on the FOMC minutes at the beginning of our chat. We're not expecting too much from there, but typically when we look at those minutes and we look at them retrospectively, we kind of use them as a gauge to see how the other governors are feeling, because they typically don't always get to express themselves as vocally as Jerome Powell does. Are we anticipating that this could at any point spook the markets in any way? I mean, I'm thinking about the fact that we got our 50 basis points when we expected 25, and right now it looks like the US soft landing is all but guaranteed. Is there anything that could come out in the next hour and a half or so that could worry us?
I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. We've got the S&P trading at highs. We've got the NASDAQ just off highs. Markets are strong. I think, if anything, what was going to spook the interest rate decisions in terms of, you know, what will the next... They've got two more meetings this year. We've only got one more. I think the jobs data on Friday with unemployment, which really says to the Fed, you could do 25 at the next meeting. Totally fine, maybe even, you know, a zero. But I don't think there's going to be much, because I think the data has shifted to a degree. What we will look to see is the what was the argument for the 25, and was there any argument for zero? But I think the biggest story is, what's the argument for 25, so we can try and get a sense to the November meeting. I don't think it's going to be earth-shattering. I think the market's just a little bit bored and, as I said, sort of out of result season and kind of looking for something to look for.
If the market's bored at the moment, what is there to look forward to for the rest of the year? I mean, we typically go through, as you said, earnings are going to start coming through now. We're going to do that last round of earnings before the end of the year. And then markets do tend to quieten down by December or so. But that US election, we can't ignore it, can we?
We absolutely can't. The US election is significant. There are differences between the candidates, which have economic difference, implementation, different story. Trump's idea of tariffs on everything is bottom line inflationary. That's just simple. Kamala Harris wanting to probably spend more. Sure, that means more taxes. I think, and those are broadly the two divides. If Kamala comes in, we can expect more taxes. Donald Trump comes in, we can expect more tariffs. In terms of efficiency, a lot's going to depend on what we see in the Congress and the Senate as well, generally. But I think, I mean, it's going to be a big one. I'm watching commodities. I'm watching oil. I'm watching gold. They the two that are sort of your temperature gauges in a hot planet right now.
Very interesting things to be watching at this point. Simon, before I let you go, I want to look at some local announcements. We got confirmation from Afrimat. They gave us a trading statement for 6 months ended the 31st of August. Doesn't seem like there was a lot to be surprised about there, but it was more just a guide around HEPS and earnings per share that's going to be coming out. They have to give that guide in line with JSE requirements, of course, for certain provisions. I see it's a decrease. I see it's not looking good from a headline earnings per share perspective, between 70 and 85% down from last reporting period. That's interesting for a company like Afrimat that has been doing well coming out of the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. I expected a loss, and I'll touch on that in a moment. It is more than I would perhaps have thought. At the top end, they're going to lose 65.9 and 39.5 at the bottom. To me, it's a little bit worse. But I think there are a couple of things. We knew Lafarge was going to be a drag. That's in the numbers now. Lafarge, we know it's a mess. It's going to take them some time and some money. I don't think it's, and we can see a lot of that money going through this 6 month update. The time that they've, you know, the Andreas van Heerden has sort of seconded the CFO to manage this. If anyone can do a deal, it is Afrimat. The reputation absolutely says that. So the Lafarge loss, we expected iron ore under pressure, prices under pressure. We know that. They had some other challenges we weren't aware of that took a little more pressure out of it. I thought it was expected. It's going to be another tough 6 months for the rest of their financial year through to February as well. A little bit worse, but not by any massive amount. And the stock was off a third of a percent on a red day. I think the market said, yep, we kind of get this. It started the day a whole lot lower. It was down at 62, close to just over 65. We saw it coming.
We saw it coming. Very interesting. We'll leave it at that, Simon. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights, as always. Simon Brown, founder at Just One Lap, joining me to reflect on the market movements throughout the day, as well as some SENS announcements that we got from some local companies.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So Transnet still having a couple of issues privatizing that Durban port. If you remember back in July of last year, there was a tender process that went through. There was a preferred bidder that was announced, and then the drama began. That drama is not over. It looks as though there's been another court judgment in that matter. And I'm joined on the line by Glenn Robbins, who's an independent economist, to take a look at this, try and make sense of it and see what it means. Good evening, Glenn. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the interdict itself and what was happening in court. I mean, the last we heard about this case was that there was an extension that was granted on the validity of the tender process from the 30th of September to the 25th of March next year. There is a preferred bidder in place, but what was the court interdict about?
Essentially, what the court has done is say that there's sufficient information that the court feels is valid that would allow for AP Moller, the entity that's contesting the award of the concession, to have their matters heard. So effectively, the court is blocking Transnet from implementing that concession agreement with ICTSI. And now this matter goes before the courts to be heard in full as to whether or not the manner in which Transnet adjudicated the concession is valid in terms of the procedures that they themselves set out.
Glenn, do we know from AP Moller's perspective what it is they're looking to achieve with this? Are they trying to have the entire tender process restarted? Are they trying to remove the elected preferred bidder? Do we kind of have an idea of what their ultimate goal is here?
Well, I mean, they, as you might expect, don't have much to say in public about these kinds of matters. But effectively, they feel that there was a decision that was made that was unfair and that lacked validity in terms of due process. And they would put it to the courts that basically that the Transnet would need to adjudicate their concession from scratch, applying the measures as they originally set out. So the court would need to determine whether or not that would be an appropriate remedy. And AP Moller might have other remedies that they might seek, but we won't know until that case actually begins on the substantive matters.
Glenn, you mentioned that the interdict seeks to prevent Transnet from proceeding with the implementation of this privatization initiative from their part. Does it affect the ongoing operations right now of the port? Is this legal battle having a negative impact on actual operations?
I mean, Transnet continue through TPT, Transnet Port Terminals, to run the facility in the same way that they've been running it previously, but hopefully with some improvements along the way. And they have made it clear that they will continue to provide an uninterrupted service. And so in that sense, what it delays, though, is the introduction of this new company that would be formed with joint shareholding between Transnet and the concession party, who would then both invest in kind of capital equipment to recapitalize the terminal and bring in new management capabilities, technology to improve the standards of performance in the terminal. So it kind of postpones some of that because Transnet basically doesn't have the funds to commit to major capital works. And secondly, it's found it very challenging to turn around some of the struggling aspects of its performance in and around that container terminal.
Glenn, do we know if these delays are going to have an impact on Transnet's balance sheet? I mean, you mentioned obviously not having the cost to outlay the capex required to refurbish and expand the terminal and everything. As the terminal currently stands, is it a profitable terminal for Transnet, or is it costing them money and that's probably why they wanted to privatize it in the first place?
I mean, you know, Transnet is making money on the terminal. It's doing business. It's just doing it in an suboptimal way. And I mean, effectively, Transnet run effectively a monopoly around container handling around our ports. There are a couple of smaller terminals that do handle some containers. So there's not really anywhere else people who want to move cargo can go. I mean, they can try insist on using some of the other ports and within the Transnet stable, and that might bring some business away from the Port of Durban and that particular terminal. But what it does do, if there's continued sort of poor performance, then the shipping lines will impose basically penalty fees on the port for making calls into the Port of Durban to try and recover the costs of delays and slow performance in terms of container handling. And that gets passed on to the people who own the cargo, and that in turn gets passed on to us as consumers. And it affects our competitiveness and export terms. It also affects the prices we ultimately pay, whether it's in the supermarket or, you know, in terms of spare parts for machinery and equipment and the like. So, you know, what Transnet are doing is that they have made commitments, and Treasury has allowed them to put in orders for some new equipment to, so it's not as if they're doing nothing in the terminal by any means. They are working quite hard to, under the sort of supervision of the National Logistics Crisis Committee, to try and improve matters. So some of that equipment will come through next year. There have been quite considerable delays in procurement of straddle carriers and cranes and the like. So they're not standing still, but it doesn't really look good for dealing with the sort of really urgent underlying performance matters that ultimately everyone was hoping this new arrangement would resolve for the sort of medium to longer term future.
Glenn, is there merit in revisiting the tendering process? I mean, looking back at some of the information that we have, we know that AP Moller had offered 2 billion rand less than what the preferred bidder was for the stake in the terminal. Is there any merit in saying, let's scrap everything, start over for the sake of moving this along and not having protracted court battles?
I mean, it'll be interesting to see what the kind of courts set out in terms of their findings, whether they find that ultimately the tender needed to be rerun. And we'll, you know, that's really something the lawyers will battle over. I mean, Transnet could try and withdraw the whole arrangement and start from scratch anyway, but it would probably be interdicted from doing that by TSI, who in a sense are the ones who hold the award as it is at the moment. So they're in a really challenging position. I think, you know, this hasn't been a surprise to many people who watch the port closely. I think there was a sense that maybe under the crisis that the ports were experiencing, you know, in 2021-22, and that Transnet sort of was under huge pressure to, I suppose what you could say is kind of rush this process. And if you also think about it, that Transnet's own systems of governance and its own internal processes have really been taking a knock in the past decade, and those are only really being rebuilt at present. So what it means is that, you know, all sorts of parties that do business with Transnet know that they're in a particularly weak and vulnerable position. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily make for a process that has a lot of widespread kind of buy-in from different stakeholders. And I think even the National Logistics Crisis Committee were kind of quite concerned about some of the terms that Transnet tried to put in the original concession arrangements, including on the rail deals. And, you know, effectively the bulk of those arrangements have all ended up in encountering challenges of one sort or another. And, you know, I think there are questions to be asked about the extent to which there's real capacity and whether or not a more kind of cautious process, perhaps drawing on much wider and deeper expertise and knowledge, might not have been a better way to go. But that wasn't done, and we are where we are now.
Sometimes it feels like one step forward and two steps back, but we'll have to wait and see how the story unfolds. For now, we'll keep an eye on the news updates as well as the court releases. Thank you so much, Glenn, for the time and for the insights. That's Glenn Robbins, who is an independent economist on the latest developments in Transnet's bid to privatize their Durban port.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA here on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with Ketso Gordon, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the South African SME Fund. Among the topics of conversation, why small businesses need to be paid in 30 days, the art of blended financing, and why scalability is not necessarily important in small businesses.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
From Transnet's woes to Google's woes, they seem to be running into some trouble with the US government. And I'm joined on the line by economist and tech enthusiast at Business Day, Mudiwa Gavaza, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Mudiwa, good evening. Lovely to speak to you as always. It's always awkward when the US government feels you've started an illegal monopoly and now wants to do something about it. What's going on here?
Well, Jimmy, I think I'm just going to start with a little bit of a rant on this one because, you know, when you hear about the American economy, they always espouse free markets, capitalism, and all of this. But when you see these cases, it feels like it's, you know, free markets to a point. It's capitalism to a point. It's growth, you know, to a point because, you know, right now it feels like Google has simply been too successful. You know, in its various endeavors, and now there is a pitch to actually break up the company. Let's hive off the Android operating system. Let's hive off the Chrome web browser, and you know, leave Google with some of its other, you know, properties, the search engine YouTube. You know, the Gemini AI, that type of thing. But who knows, you know, if something like this is to actually go through, you know, where it might actually end up stopping, because each one of those constituents that make up the Google enterprise is a behemoth in its own right.
Mudiwa, has this ever happened? I can't remember a time where a government has come into a private company, forced them to effectively unbundle, and whatever shape or form that unbundling comes in, we can get to and speculate around. But have we ever seen this before where the government, aside from other economies like China, where we know this is standard protocol, but as you said, in a free market like America, where capitalism is supposedly being pushed left, right, and center, has this ever happened?
Well, the closest that something like this has come to happening with one of the so-called big tech companies in the US was Microsoft in the late 90s. You know, those that have been following technology for some time will remember that there was, you know, huge issues around, you know, some of the accusations of monopoly around Microsoft, especially when it came to what were termed at the time the browser wars. You had Internet Explorer, and then you had Netscape at the time. And we had Microsoft that was bundling. Understandably, the business model makes perfect sense today in 2024. But back then, it was seen as being a little bit unfair that Microsoft would bundle the Windows operating system together with a default web browser that was Internet Explorer. And there was huge pressure, you know, at the time, and they faced a similar situation to what Google, you know, faced right now. There was a call for a breakup, and that didn't end up, you know, end up happening. But, you know, you can draw parallels. The irony with that particular case is that if you fast forward almost 30 years, Internet Explorer isn't exactly what one would consider a major player in the in the browser landscape, because Google Chrome has emerged as the big player. You've also got the likes of Firefox, Safari, all of these all of these other players. But when it comes to US history, probably the most famous example is the breakup of John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil in the early 20th century. And that breakup resulted in a number of companies that still exist today, such as Chevron.
Muriwa, does this open up the door to foreign competition coming into the market? I mean, you touched on the fact that IE is not necessarily a real competitor at the moment towards Google. And I think about international guys that might be operating perhaps out of China. You think about the likes of Bing. Does this open that up to say, if this forced open or forced unbundling takes place and the US government is of the view that this is a monopoly, then surely new entrants into that space would challenge that monopoly?
Well, interestingly, Jimmy, when it comes to something like this, right, specifically, if we're going to look at the world of search, which is where a lot of this is emanating from, because when you look at Google's business model as a whole, whether we're talking about Gmail, we're talking about YouTube, the Android operating system, the Chrome browser, Google Pay, almost all of the things that make up Google are in service of increasing, the chat, not the chat, the search piece of Google's business, because that has been the biggest money spinner up until now, right? So you have that element there. This particular case, at least for now, you can see that U.S. authorities are trying to, I guess, regulate or at least fix the market structure in the U.S. Most of the competitors that are cited when it comes to what's happening are the American players. So there's Bing, which is owned by Microsoft. That's an alternative search. And then you've also got Yahoo. And then I think the other one that people often refer to is DuckDuckGo, right? Those are the elements of rivals in the space. You don't really see, really big competition from Europe. But if you look in Asia, you have a lot of, really big players, because you know that in China, the likes of Google are not permitted to operate in that country. So the search engines that have become big, when it comes to scale, you have really big players in that part of the world. But at least for now, I wouldn't say that foreign competition would be the biggest threat to Google, but rather maybe one of the domestic guys, your DuckDuckGo, your Yahoo, your Bing, possibly, being the ones that could increase some of their market share. And also Yelp, there's a whole bunch of these places that are out there that people are thinking of. And now the next phase of the discussion is AI, because more and more people are turning to AI to ask those questions. And then you have the AI going online and actually getting you those answers. So if we're talking about the evolution of a search engine, then the next phase that we need to, logically discuss is what's going to happen with the AI piece.
I suspect we have a lot more to look forward to, especially if the US government starts to get involved in these things. But we'll have to leave it at that for now. Muriwa, thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Muriwa Gavaza, economist and tech enthusiast at Business Day, joining me to take a look at the latest developments that could potentially see Google unbundling.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're taking a look at the consumer outlook for South Africa. We've heard many analysts share their expectations around what's happening, as well as where we could be headed from a markets point of view and from a financial point of view. But what about the consumer? What about consumer spending and consumer habits? And are consumers actually feeling like the turnaround is here? And are they feeling like this new government has created new opportunities? I'm joined on the line by the Managing Director for Nielsen IQ in South Africa. That's Zach Hyrie, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Zach. Thanks so much for taking the time. You guys at NIQ have put out a very interesting report around just the state of the consumer. Tell us about it.
Thanks, Jimmy. Yeah, so like you say, we've got a little bit of history in the country in South Africa, right? It's been a tough few years. I think everybody would accept that. But there are some glimmers of hope, I think, coming from a lot of different sources. So also coming through in the report that we've published. I'll give you a few statistics, right? So inflation is down quite significantly. I think CPI is at 4.4%. Consumer confidence, it's at an all-time high. Well, not an all-time high, I should say. It's a five-year high. In our own research, we're also seeing that the percentage of people who are telling us that they're worse off financially this year versus last year has decreased quite substantially. And then also on the flip side of that, the percentage telling us that their financial situation has improved is also quite a lot higher than what it was this time last year. I think it might have something to do with the changes that you've already referenced, you know, the changing landscape in South Africa. But it's also got a lot to do with the price, the inflationary pressure coming a little bit down and easing off. Interest rates down, JSE top 40 up 18% year on year. And then I think it's also got something to do with quite a lot of applications for withdrawals from the Tupop pension system. So we're told that there's been requests on several billions of rands to be accessed from those two-pot pension schemes. So I think, yeah, there is a lot of things going on, and there's a lot of, I think, positivity. Also, just as a small anecdote, you know, I travel across the country and I make it my business to talk to executives in different cities across the country, but I also talk to people in the service economy, like taxi drivers and waiters and that kind of thing. And in general, I'd say there is cautious optimism.
That cautious optimism, Zach, still comes through when we look at some of the spending habits of consumers. I mean, we're still seeing that some consumers are still electing to find value even in these difficult times. Yes, interest rates are still high. They are starting to come down, but they haven't really come down yet. And some consumers are still saying, we're going to look for value in different ways, whether it's looking through sales, whether it's looking through promotions and other sorts of things, buying in bulk. Are you seeing that trend kind of consistent through consumer spending and the spending habits?
Absolutely, yeah. So real wages are down year on year still. And like you say, inflation is still there. So it's still quite high. When we talk to consumers, that is their top concern, food inflation. And they respond behaviorally. So that happens across the different, you know, socioeconomic groups in South Africa. There's no one who's really immune. Like we see overall groceries, they're up in terms of the total amount of money that we're spending on groceries in South Africa. It's up by 4.3% year on year. But this is totally driven by price. When we look at volumes, which is, of course, stripping out price, when we're looking at volumes, those are, in fact, down in terms of groceries, about 2.5%. And that's across the basket of grocery goods in South Africa. And what we see when we're looking within the basket, we see a lot of the choices that consumers are making. They are very much driven by price. So it's a very price-sensitive market, very price-driven market. I'll give you a few examples. So if we, we see the categories with the highest inflation, we see across those, volumes are down. And that would be things like rice, eggs, coffee, and sugar. Overall, seeing levels of inflation above 15%, so well above the CPI, and we're seeing volume declines across the board on those, and in some cases really extreme, like eggs down 20%. But then on the flip side, where we look to categories where were, much lower than CPI, the inflation is a lot lower than CPI, such as oils and candy and frozen meats, we see that volumes are up on those. So it's definitely a price-driven market. But we also think that, you know, with that price driving a lot of the behavior, consumer preferences might also be shifting.
Zach, when we look at those shifting preferences, what still concerns consumers at the moment? Are there obviously some of the macro factors that are beyond consumers' control are always going to be there in the back of consumers' minds? But what else is still concerning consumers and preventing them from or having them use specific spending habits and see things in a specific light?
So, like I said, it is a tough situation in South Africa. You know, tax levels are not particularly low for the people who are being taxed in the country. We've got about, I think it's 7 million people who are eligible to pay tax. And then there's about three times that who are receiving sort of government grants. So there is a real pressure on the pocket in South Africa. We look to research across different countries globally, and I'd say South Africa is extremely price sensitive. So consumers are always looking for ways in which they can try to control the spend. I think one thing they're also looking at is trying to find alternative means of deriving an income. So looking to secondary sources of income like hustle culture, that kind of thing. When we talk to consumers, there's quite a high proportion of them in South Africa. It's like 83% of them. They're telling us that they're looking for alternative means of making income, so secondary sources of income. And that's considerably higher than what we see in a global average. Also, you know, you think about all of the platforms, the technology, all of that kind of stuff that's available more and more. And that, I think, is enabling that kind of accessing other countries, other industries where maybe there is a little bit more, you know, economic development and economic growth.
Zach, what have consumers given up on? In terms of some expenditure items or some budgetary constraints or things around consumer habits, what if consumers just said, look, can't do this anymore?
Yeah, so I think it's going to vary depending on the household. I think what we've seen is that, you know, the bigger ticket items, maybe people are holding back on purchasing some of those. So maybe not replacing big ticket electronic items or household appliances maybe as frequently as they have been in the past. We've seen some unit pressure on sales of those kinds of products. But then we've also seen maybe an uptick in the littler pleasures that people have, like that they might be picking up within a grocery outlet, you know, like sort of things that maybe would give them a little bit of satisfaction on a more frequent day-to-day basis. So, you know, we're not letting go of those sorts of things at all, Jimmy. In fact, when we look to the rank of the categories that we spend most money on in South Africa, it's pretty stable. So that will be beer, soft drinks, bread, cigarettes, and then frozen meat. So those are all still like the categories that we spend the most amount of money on in South Africa. But then there has been quite a lot of shift, a little bit of shift when we look within the basket. So if we look at the top 50 categories, we can see a little bit of movement. And it is, like I said, very driven by price, but I think it's also intertwined with changing consumer preferences. So soft drinks are down quite a lot in volume terms year on year. It's about 9%. But then we see energy drinks up 4%. Frozen meats are up nearly 5% volume terms, but then eggs, like I said, is down above 20%. Maize back in favor. Maize was like disfavored versus rice, and rice we saw a big uptake, but that has now reversed. And again, it's very much driven by inflationary changes on those different categories. And then in alcohol as well. I think this is also driven quite a lot by changing consumer preferences. So we see a big uptick in premixed drinks, premixed alcohol, and then we see a bit of a decline in things like cider and wine. So yeah, we do see a little bit of changes, but like the percentage amounts that I'm talking about, you can probably kind of picture it. They're big for our clients, right? They're big for our clients, and we discuss those with them at length. But then from a customer's perspective, you know, we're not talking necessarily about major shifts, and you know, we are all creatures of habit after all, and we love those little pleasures, so we're not going to do without the beer and cigarettes anytime soon.
Zach, going into 2025, are we likely to see consumer habits change or any trends starting to emerge at this point? And are we back to sort of pre-COVID sentiment from the South African consumer's perspective?
So, look, consumer confidence, like I said, is a five-year high. We're expecting that to continue into next year. I think quite a lot of our expectations for what's going to happen next year probably baked into the system already. So I don't think we're forecasting anything that's going to be drastically out of line with what we already have seen this year. Possibly some upside in terms of the forecast. Some of those forecasts maybe need a little bit of revision upwards, provided we continue on the positive momentum that's been built up this year. So I don't think we're expecting some major shifts within the consumer landscape next year. But, you know, Jimmy, we're conducting this research every 6 months. So I think in the next 6 months, we should see what the results tell us.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how it plays out and how things shape up, especially from a consumer outlook perspective. There's a lot that can drive that consumer sentiment. We'll leave it at that. Zach, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That Zach Hayeri, who is the Managing Director for Nielsen IQ for South Africa, on the outlook for consumers and what consumers might be thinking.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's that part of our Wednesday when we do our executive lounge feature and we chat to an executive and try and get to know them a little bit better outside of their working environment. Today's executive is someone you might all be familiar with. He's the CEO of the organization Undoing Tax Abuse, Wayne Duvenager. And he joins me on the line now to get a bit of an idea of what he does when he's not at Outer. Good evening, Wayne. Lovely to speak to you, as always. Thanks so much for the time. How does someone go from 20 plus years at Avis to Outer? Take me through that journey.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting one. I'd been in the in that role as the chief executive for 5 years. We'd done some exciting stuff, and I guess, you know, when you've been in a role for some time, you're looking for opportunities. But I wasn't really looking. The whole ETOL saga just started unfolding, and I'd written an article about what an inefficient farce this whole plan was, and it became a headline news. And I think for the first time, business was speaking out against the scheme. At that stage, it was all Cassato and the DA. It was a political football, and it sucked me into the debate and the discussion. But really, we got our industry body did a lot of research on what was actually going on, and we had to take a stand. We had to make a decision: are we going to challenge this or not? And we convinced the industry to do so, and that needed full-time attention. And I guess the timing was right. I had an exit plan with my employers at the time then, and decided to go down this road, which I thought would take a year or two for government to come to their senses on what was really a ridiculous plan. And it ended up becoming a 12-year career in civil activism. Certainly not something I'd planned for, but it evolved into that. Yeah.
Wayne, did you plan for Whispering Pines? Because that was a surprise as well.
Yeah. So what happened was we took a drive out, and this little farm was going up for sale in Magaliesburg. And my wife and I had always had a plan to sort of develop a little country lodge. And it was in between one of my parts of a time at Avis. And we thought, let's go and do this, take a step out of the corporate life and develop a little country lodge. So we did that, at 4-star, 14 rooms, and had some fun doing that for a while. And then I was asked to come back into the corporate world. And that's what happened. That was around about 2001, 2002.
What was the most rewarding thing about Whispering Pines, about being out of the corporate space and kind of being your own boss has its challenges, but what was the most rewarding thing about running that lodge?
You know, it was just seeing people appreciate finding a spot that was really off the beaten track. So it was a real stress-free zone. We designed it around people wanting to just connect with nature and have absolute solitude and good dining. And that's really what it was. So it was so nice to see people, same type of person I was in my stressed out corporate life, coming through the gates, entering into space, and within a few hours, absolutely, totally relaxed and unwinding and disconnecting with the rat race. It was really good to see how people connected with their souls, I think.
Wayne, how do you unwind now? I mean, understanding that you have a lot to do with Outer, you're still involved very clearly in the activism work that you do. How do you unwind?
Sure, it's difficult. Corruption never sleeps. You're constantly, even on the weekends, having to deal with inquiries and stuff. But look, I do. I mean, I'm a family man, so relax quite a bit. I recently built a hot house.
and a little greenhouse, and so now I'm starting to learn the art of growing my our own vegetables, and so that's a nice pastime. It's keeping me busy, and I built it with a helper, and we just got stuck in and planned it and had some fun. So that's one thing that keeps me busy on some weekends. I dine and then try and travel a little bit, but not too much internationally now, more locally.
What's the favorite place you've traveled to?
Favorite place I've traveled to with my wife, we enjoyed the Loire Valley in France. I think it was a really a great trip to learn about a lot of the history those periods and times in France when the bourgeoisie were having to, I don't know, find their way in developing the economies then. But yeah, I love France. It's a beautiful country.
Wayne, you started out at Avis in 1985, so four decades ago almost. What are you looking forward to the most about retirement? Are you even planning to retire anytime soon?
Never plan to retire.
You tried it, it didn't work.
Yeah, it wasn't really retirement. I think you're always got to keep yourself busy and never get into that mindset. And if you enjoy what you're doing, then it's great, so long as you're having fun and moving forward. So it was a long time ago, but it seemed like yesterday. You know, it was a great journey that I learned all my business skills and I think ethics at Avis. It was a good organization.
What does fun look like now, Wayne? I imagine, as you said, growing your own vegetables is one of the things that you enjoy doing, but what does fun look like on a weekend?
Fun is a good game of golf when I'm having a good game, and relaxing and entertaining with friends, getting out and about. It's really being local. It's not going too far. I cycle quite a bit as well with a group of mates. So yeah, it's a combination of cycling, golf, chilling, eating, having some fun with friends.
When it comes to eating, what would you say is the worst meal you've had, and what would you say is the best you've had?
The worst was a sheep's head that I had down in the Free State Big Dam. Karip, we spent a weekend down there and tried a sheep's head. It was bad. Well, I guess it's a delicacy for some, but I didn't enjoy it at all. That was the worst. The best is we enjoy Greek food, eh? Love Greek food.
I imagine the sheep head is probably an acquired taste that would take a lot to get used to. When you think about just your career and you reflect on the four decades that have been, what would you say has been the most valuable lesson you've carried through?
Well, sorry, I just lost you for a second. In my career,
yeah.
Most valuable lesson.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in leadership. It comes down to accountability, and it's one of the things we struggle with as a country, and certainly the public sector. One thing I did learn is that you can speak up, and you should listen to people that are within the organization. You never must think that you fill a leadership role that you can't take advice and learn from people within the organization. And we had a very learning culture from that point of view. But when it comes to people that have crossed the line, out of line, and have done wrong to the organization, you follow the policies and have fear in dealing with holding people to account. It's very, very necessary to have no fear in that space. So those are the two main factors. Be a learning organization, learn from others all the time. Put the mechanisms in place in an organization so you can have these engagements and take in the learnings from the youth, because it is the youth that see things very differently to those who work their way up into leadership organizations. And that way you evolve.
Always be willing to learn and always be willing to have a little bit of fun along the way. I think we'll leave it at that, Wayne. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. It's been lovely getting to know you outside of the working environment. That's Wayne Duvenaga, the CEO of Outer, joining us this week, not for Outer, but for our executive lounge.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we've come to the end of another show. If you've missed any of our conversations, they are available online. The podcasts are up. You can go and catch up on those conversations. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hoss is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. It also means from my side, good night.